is Wednesday, March 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton are the big winners following Tuesday's presidential primaries. At least 15 people are killed in a bus bombing in Pakistan.
A bus that was carrying government workers to work this morning, when it was passing through the center of the city of Peshawar, a bomb that was planted under a seat in the bus went off.
And take a trip back in time through a new virtual reality app. It's all ahead. New York businessman Donald Trump won three state presidential primary election contests Tuesday, bumping Republican Senator Marco Rubio out of the 2016 race for the White House. Trump took Rubio's home state of Florida, as well as North Carolina and Illinois. But he lost Ohio to the state's governor, John Kasich. Trump called it an amazing evening and already sounded like the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party in preaching unity.
We have to bring our party together. We have to bring it together. We have something happening that actually makes the Republican Party probably the biggest political story anywhere in the world. Everybody's writing about it all over Europe. All over the world, they're talking about it. Millions of people are coming in to vote. We have a great opportunity. And the people that are voting, our Democrats are coming in, independents are coming in, and very, very importantly, people that never voted before. It's an incredible thing.
Earlier, Trump won the election in the Pacific Territory of the Northern Marianas, bringing him 621 of the 1,237 delegates needed to secure the Republican Party's nomination. On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took a huge step toward securing her party's nomination against her lone rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Well, I'll tell you, this is another Super Tuesday for our campaign. Thank you, Florida. Thank you, North Carolina. Thank you, Ohio. You know, tonight, it's clearer than ever that this may be one of the most consequential campaigns of our lifetimes. The next president will walk into the Oval Office next January, sit down at that desk, and start making decisions that will affect the lives and the livelihoods of everyone in this country, indeed, everyone on this planet.
Clinton also won the Illinois primary, giving her an almost insurmountable delegate lead of 1,561 out of 2,383 needed following an embarrassing loss to Sanders in Michigan last week. Jeffrey Skelling, associate editor of the Sabato Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the headline from Tuesday's election is a dramatic fall of Marco Rubio, who chose to focus on a White House bid rather than re-election to the Senate. Skelling was asked whether Rubio has a political future in Florida politics.
There are two races in 2018 that, you know, might attract him to run in his home state again. The governorship will be up as Rick Scott will be exiting after two terms. And the other Senate seat with Bill Nelson, the Democratic incumbent there, you know, it's uncertain whether or not he will seek re-election. He's made noises that he will, but regardless, there might be an opportunity to run against Nelson. The problem for Rubio is that the Republican bench in Florida is pretty crowded. So there are a lot of ambitious politicians who've been eyeing the governorship, including Attorney General Pam Bondi, for example, who endorsed Trump. And one of the things that's happened to Rubio is that it's been argued pretty credibly that basically since he got into the Senate, he's been formulating a presidential run. And to some degree, this may have hindered and damaged his connections in building a real base of support in his home state for the long run.
What did the night mean for Donald Trump?
On the whole, it's still good news for Trump in the sense that he is still going to be the leader. He's still going to be the favorite to win the Republican nomination. He may not be able to get to a majority of the delegates by the time we're done with all the nomination contests. But, you know, if he's close, it's going to be very difficult to not make him the nominee without, you know, causing the Republican Party to implode or causing, you know, a huge split if anti-Trump forces were to try to rally to stop it. He was close.
As far as the Democrats are concerned, is Senator Bernie Sanders pretty much out of it now?
Barring some, you know, remarkable revelation about Hillary Clinton's emails or maybe something with the Clinton Foundation or, you know, something that would just be extremely, extremely damaging, you know, a federal indictment or something of the emails. I mean, at this point, the delegate math is pretty obvious. Sanders will not catch Clinton. So at this point, I mean, Sanders doesn't have a chance of being the Democratic nominee. Unless something very unexpected happens. And so I think Sanders intends on continuing. I think that's pretty clear. He and his supporters are going to want to continue, and that's going to force Clinton to fight on and to continue having to address Sanders. And there may be another debate or something. Not ideal for Clinton that he is probably not going to go quietly into the night.
Jeffrey Skelling, associate editor of the Sabato Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. The next fight for delegates in both parties is centered in the West, with contests March 22nd in Arizona, Idaho, and Utah. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's all the reaction to all this?
Oh, there's been lots of reaction from all of the different camps, certainly from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton supporters and social media. They're looking at this as the general election matchup, Trump versus Clinton. They're saying our candidates are the presumptive nominees. They've won the most delegates. They virtually swept the board, both of them. Hillary won 4 out of 5 states, and I'll talk about that last state in a second, that's still up in the air. Trump won 3 of 5. The one he didn't win was Ohio, the home state of Governor John Kasich. So Kasich supporters are saying, we've won, we can continue on. Cruz supporters, Ted Cruz finished 2nd in a lot of these cases, but wasn't getting a lot of really airtime or really attention during this. His supporters are saying, we're welcoming everybody else, including Marco Rubio's supporters. Marco Rubio, of course, senator from Florida, lost his home state of Florida to Trump, and so he dropped out of the race. And so we saw the hashtag Goodbye Rubio Tuesday was trending, which is a play on the the Rolling Stones song Goodbye Ruby Tuesday.
Oh, right, yeah.
But that state I mentioned that Hillary didn't win and Trump didn't win was Missouri, kind of in the center of the country. Trump and Cruz are separated by about 1,500 votes out of about 700,000 cast. Hillary and Bernie Sanders are separated by about 500 votes. So that is the contest everyone's looking at now, saying maybe Cruz could pick up a win, maybe Bernie Sanders could pick up a win from this otherwise disappointing day for both of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Other big story also in the kind of the political realm we're looking at, President Obama is set to nominate someone to the Supreme Court to fill the vacancy after Antonin Scalia's death. And he introduced this announcement via email. So the term made my decision was actually trending because that was what he said in this email. He said, I've made my decision on who I will nominate to the Supreme Court. Check it out tomorrow at 11 a.m. He sent that out last night to his supporters. No word who that might be, but one of the names that's top trending right now is Sri Srinivasan. He's a district circuit court judge, rumored to be the selection. So we'll see in a couple hours from now, we'll see who President Obama picks and what goes from there.
Absolutely. Should be very interesting. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Black holes aren't usually visible since material surrounding them, even light, is devoured by their intense gravity. But occasionally, a black hole can draw in material, such as a star, so rapidly that it spits some of it out, producing a powerfully bright light in the process. Last June, astronomers noticed that a black hole called V404 Cygni, some 7,800 light years from Earth, became very bright for about a 2-week period. As they observed the phenomena, they noticed the black hole also produced very bright flashes of red light that lasted only fractions of a second. The astronomers say that each of these flashes produced light so intense that it had the equivalent power of about 1,000 suns. Poshak Gandhi, lead author of a study detailing the astronomers' discovery, says that the red flashes seem to have been produced when the black hole was at the peak of its feeding frenzy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an American college student is sentenced to hard labor in North Korea. A bomb ripped through a packed bus in northwestern Pakistan Wednesday, killing at least 15 people and wounding at least 30 others. I spoke with reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about the bombing.
Yeah, what we know from officials and witnesses is that a bus that was carrying government workers to work this morning, when it was passing through the center of the city of Peshawar, a bomb that was planted under a seat in the bus went off. It was quite a powerful bomb, and the explosion basically devastated the bus, and it instantly killed 15 people, while 30 others on board the bus were critically wounded. And what we know is that the officials are saying that there was about 8 kilograms of explosives, and a time device was used to detonate the bomb, and it basically destroyed the whole bus.
Has there been any claim of responsibility for the attack?
No group has claimed responsibility as yet, but officials are suspecting that the Pakistani Taliban could be behind this bombing, because just a little more than a week ago, there was a massive suicide blast near Peshawar in the Shabkadar town that killed 17 people. And for that bombing, and even previous such attacks, the Pakistani Taliban has been claiming responsibility. But so far, we have not received any statement from this militant outfit.
Is Peshawar now on a higher alert for security because of this?
Yeah, the security has always been high in Peshawar because, you know, it is located just close to the Pakistani tribal areas, which are known for harboring local and foreign militants. And that city has always been targeted by these militants who are currently facing a massive army ground and air operation against their hideouts in the tribal areas. So these attacks, officials believe, are in reaction to the operation which has been going on in the tribal areas, and that has, according to officials, uprooted most of their bases in that area. But still, this bombing and the last week's attack clearly indicates that these militants still have the ability to carry out major attacks across the country.
That's reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan. North Korea has sentenced an American university student to 15 years hard labor for subversion after he publicly confessed to trying to steal a propaganda banner from a hotel. 21-year-old University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier, under arrest since January, was convicted and sentenced Wednesday in a one-hour trial before North Korea's Supreme Court. According to the New York Times, former New Mexico governor and veteran diplomat Bill Richardson met Tuesday with two North Korean UN diplomats to press for Warmbier's release. Richardson said the diplomats promised him they would convey the request. Richardson has been involved in gaining the freedom of other detained Americans in North Korea. The sentence comes at a time of heightened tensions over tough new UN sanctions following the North's latest nuclear test in January and a rocket launch in February. Go Myung-hyun, a research fellow at the Seoul-based ASEAN Institute for Policy Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he was not surprised at the harsh sentence given Pyongyang's penchant for hostage diplomacy.
There are precedents to this kind of hostage diplomacy conducted by North Korea. If you remember, former President Carter and former President Clinton had to visit North Korea to rescue American citizens who were being held in North Korea against their will. So I think it's a repeat of the same pattern we have seen before.
Do you think the North, by taking this action, is expecting some senior American official to come to North Korea pleading for his release?
That's correct. That's the only way North Korea can bring a senior American official to North Korea. So what really matters here is not about the content or substance for what's really going on. It's not really about actually releasing an American hostage here. It's about the appearance of a senior American official visiting North Korea and maybe even actually meeting, depending on the status and the level of the senior American official, right? But then what matters to the North Korean regime is holding meeting. Appearance of having meeting with a senior American official to be used as probably as a domestic propaganda.
And you think this senior American official, whoever it may turn out to be, North Korea wants to speak with that person about current tensions?
North Korea will try to, but I don't think that they really care about that much, because they understand that there are other communication channels to hold discussions about the current tensions in the Korean Peninsula besides having a face-to-face meeting in Pyongyang. For instance, they can just email State Department official if they want to have a meeting to have a discussion about substantial issues about the Korean Peninsula. So there's a need for that. That's the reason why I believe North Koreans are going to use this occasion as a way to showcase how North Korean regime is capable of calling in any senior level of North American official to Pyongyang.
The New York Times reports that former Governor Bill Richardson, who was an envoy at one time to North Korea, met with the North's ambassador to the UN on Tuesday to press for the release of this young man. Mm-hmm. He said he urged the humanitarian release of Otto Warmbier, and they agreed to convey the request. Do you think Mr. Richardson might be a likely candidate to come to North Korea?
Yeah, he's been to North Korea several times for the same mission. But then what I'm afraid of is that North Korea might be looking for a fresh face in this occasion. Maybe even like a higher-ranking official.
And Go Myung-hyun says, given past experience, he does not expect Warmbier to serve out his full 15 years. He suggests the matter may be resolved soon after the North Korean Communist Party Congress in May. In the meantime, he says he doubts Warmbier will experience the kind of harsh incarceration reserved for North Koreans. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. If you've ever wanted to see what life was like in another time, a new virtual reality app lets you do just that. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Time Looper app is taking people back in time at several historic sites.
If you visit the Tower of London, you will see the building with the moat drained. But if you use a new Time Looper app, the modern city melts away and you're in 1255 London. What are now city streets are fields, and the tower is surrounded by water, all by using your smartphone and a simple cardboard viewer. Andrew Feinberg is the co-founder of Time Looper, which uses virtual reality technology on your smartphone to transport you to another time.
We actually overlay the current infrastructure with what the infrastructure of the tower and the surrounding environment was like in 13th century London. So, for example, now you see a Starbucks, and now you see the tower as it looks today with the moat drain. When we take you back in time, you actually see the historically accurate representation of the tower in its heyday.
Feinberg and his co-founder, Yit Yitter, first do historical research on the sites. Then they record the modern site in 360-degree virtual reality video. Then, using a green screen and costumed actors, they recreate the site as it was in an earlier time. After some 3D modeling and some visual effects, suddenly Trafalgar Square in London is not in 2016, but in 1940 during the Nazi Blitzkrieg. Swarms of German bombers appear in the sky, and one actually drops a bomb near Nelson's Column, an iconic landmark in London. Yit Yitter says the technology enhances the experience for people who might see the modern view but have no idea what happened there.
Nothing replaces the experience of being on site, but you don't always know what the stories are about those sites. So the first thing is, experience those destinations, Colosseum, even without going there, and getting more excited about that destination. And then the second thing is, when you arrive, learning more about those stories.
Time Looper is a boon for the tourist industry, allowing visitors to see the Great Fire of London or the Thames River's Tower Bridge before it was a bridge. Ruth Poling is a Blue Badge tourist guide in London.
I think it's just really, really immersive. I mean, my job is a storyteller. I'm here to conjure up what things are like. And this just gives me something else I can use, particularly with small children, getting them really engaged in the story that I'm telling.
Chris Early, the head of Tower Bridge, says Time Looper helps people understand the impact of historical events.
You might be able to experience the looking at the Great Fire from stood at home, but when you're actually up here in the walkways, you get a sense of where it all happened. And of course, the second that the experience finished, you're looking at exactly the same view, but in the modern day. So it gives it a lot more context.
Time Looper plans to launch in New York City in April. There, visitors will be able to see Times Square on VJ Day in August of 1945. They'll also get to see workers eating lunch atop a skyscraper during construction of Rockefeller Center in 1932. Following their launch last year, Feinberg and Yitter have been busy doing deals with other locations, from China to Spain. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That sounds pretty fascinating. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of Energy Elizabeth Sherwood Randall and Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs for the Republic of Korea, Cho Tae-yul, announced on March 3rd the launch of the High-Level Bilateral Commission, the HLBC. In their roles as co-chairs, Deputy Secretary Sherwood Randall and Vice Minister Cho also announced that the first meeting of the HLBC will take place in Seoul on April 14th. Deputy Secretary Sherwood Randall will travel to Seoul to co-chair the HLBC as part of a trip focused on nuclear security, safety, nonproliferation, and clean energy. Established pursuant to the terms of the Agreement for Cooperation between the United States of America and the Republic of Korea concerning peaceful uses of nuclear energy, often referred to as the US-ROK 123 Agreement, the HLBC will serve as a senior-level forum to facilitate strategic dialogue and technical exchanges on peaceful nuclear cooperation between the two countries. In particular, the HLBC will examine the management of spent nuclear fuel, the promotion of nuclear exports and export control cooperation, assurances of nuclear fuel supply, and nuclear security. Upon announcement of the HLBC, Deputy Secretary of Energy Sherwood Randall said, "The United States and the Republic of Korea share over 30 years of close cooperation on civil nuclear energy. The creation of the HLBC reaffirms our nation's deep commitment to our joint efforts on nuclear safety and builds on our history of mutually beneficial collaboration in this area." Deputy Secretary Sherwood Randall's and Vice President Cho's meeting established the structure and functions of the four working groups established in the 123 Agreement and confirmed the group's membership. The first official task for the working groups is to develop terms of reference and work plans that will be presented to the HLBC co-chairs for approval at their April meeting. The United States is proud to work with its partner, the Republic of Korea, to ensure the peaceful and safe use of nuclear energy for the benefit of the people of the ROK, the Korean Peninsula, and the East Asia and Pacific region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.